Okay, so just let me first introduce myself. I'm Olivier Tenaillon. I work in a medical school in the north of Paris, so where the Olympics will be in 2024. Just to sum up my career, I started doing a PhD with Miroslav Radman, François Taleb, and Matic on evolution mutation rate, and I did a postdoc with Lin Chao, just there a few weeks ago, on viral evolution. And I joined a lab in which we work, and we created a lab in which we work on E. coli epidemiology and genomics. And then I did a sabbatical, 2-year sabbatical with Tony, Brandon Goat, and Al Bennett in Irvine to do some more genomics, and we keep doing that. And so during all these years, I've been working on E. coli. And so all of you know pretty much E. coli because you've cloned or evolved it in some ways, but one of the reasons we work on it is also because it's one of the microbes for which we know a lot about its ecology. And so it's a commensal of the guts of vertebrates, and it cycles to the environment to go back from one host to the other. But also we studied in medical school because, apart from being a commensal, it's a pretty nasty and versatile pathogen. So you may have experienced it around the world when you travel, because it's causing diarrhea. The turista could be partly linked to E. coli. Used to kill 1 million kids a year in the 70s due to Shigellas, that are some E. coli with a given plasmid. But these numbers have been reduced gladly to less than 10,000 to 20,000 over the last 2 decades or so. But over the years, it's also creating also a lot of infection. So every other woman will do urinary tract infection due to E. coli that can go up and then go to the blood. And also you have some newborn meningitis. And all these numbers make it now that it's killing about 1 million person a year. And this is a big number, and the perspective are not good, because 15 years ago we could control it fairly well. But now, so this is my long-term collaborator, Eric Denamur, and they've been doing some studies in France, for instance. This is different phylogroups of E. coli, and over the last decades you see some drastic change. And this group, the B2 group, has increased a lot in frequency. It was already high in the US, in the Western world. It's much higher than if you go in French Guiana, in the tropics, in the forest, it would be like less than 5%. But here, so the French are being westernized, and they're having the same diet as the Americans, presumably, so the B2 are increasing. And those ones actually are loaded with virulence factors, and now also they tend to be more and more resistant to antibiotics. And so over the last 2 decades, E. coli, who was not a worry in the hospital, is becoming public enemy number one, because you arrived in the hospital with your E. coli within your gut that is highly virulent and highly resistant. And so as soon as you're weak, it's going to go in the blood in some way and then make a lot of damage. And so all the people in the hospital are really worried about that for elderly people, intensive care units, and so on. And so that's for the sad part of the story. But then the question, what's going on? And of course, we're interested in trying to understand how does E. coli evolve. And so one of the part I'm going to talk about that today. And so the question is, are there any rules about the adaptation of E. coli? And what have we learned from experimental evolution? Because that's one way to know what's going on. And in the second part, I'll try to extrapolate to some longer-term effect. So most of the results I'm going to talk about are linked to what Rich presented somehow, about, you know, evolving in flasks by serial transfers lineages, and then sequencing some of the genomes. So that's one of the ways to explore the genomics of adaptation. And most of the results, so I will give some rules first, and most of the results come from 2 experiments. So one we did with Tony, Brandon Goat, and Al Bennett, in which we took one of the lineage from Rich Lenski that evolved for 2,000 generations, and then it was shifted to a temperature, 42.2 degrees, so it was the same media, but the temperature was the highest temperature where you could get a 100-fold dilution on a daily basis. So it was really pushing the organism to its limit, and then it was evolved like 120 isolates, in the end, we had 114 different genomes that evolved for 2,000 generations. And the other one is the one that Rich presented, in which we sequenced some of these, I mean, these 12 lineages, 2 clones per point. But this time, it's a much longer timescale. So on one, we have like short-term somehow, but a lot of replicates, and the other one, we have longer-term. So we have the 2 different perspectives. And so it was Rich, but also the Schneider and Jeff Barrick. So what I'm going to first try to sum up some of the rules, I mean, based on those experiments, but also many others, about, you know, what have we learned about experimental evolution. The first thing is that when you evolve things, you know, fitness increases, okay? That's the first rule, okay? It was observed early on, but that's the first one that's observed. The second one is that this fitness increase actually depend on the initial fitness. And so I think the first paper I found that was also a rich paper, in which he took two strains resistant to bacteriophage T4, but that had different levels of cost. It was costly to different levels, and we adapted them for 400 generations, which was before the long term. He found that the one that started with a lower fitness improved their fitness much more than the one that had a lower cost. And this has been consistently found again and again, either as what he presented, you know, through time. If you look through time, you see that the increase when you hear is smaller than what you expect, than the increase when you hear. So as fitness increases, you get less. Or alternatively, people have used many, many different isolates with different initial fitness and evolved them independently. Michael and Sergey have been doing that. And Alejandro from the lab, compiled different data sets ranging from viruses, yeast, E. coli. And when you look, if you look at the initial fitness and the rate of fitness improvement, I mean, we brought back to per generation, you see there's always the more maladapted you are, the faster you adapt, which is somehow positive. You know, you can improve faster when you down. But that's very consistent across all systems that have been sampled so far. So the third rule that we see is that whenever we start looking at the genome, one of the first thing we can do as molecular, as you do molecular evolution, is to look at one of the bases, K over KS, the fraction of synonymous to non-synonymous mutations. And as Rich showed, you know, in his experiment, this ratio here would be a ratio of 1. You find an excess, it's decaying, but still much larger than 1. In the thermal adaptation, the value was 5. And in almost every system, when you look and sequence, you find that there's an excess of non-synonymous mutations. So for molecular evolution, this is the proof that there's adaptations going on. Now, if we go at the genomic level, as soon as we have some replicates, or even sometimes within population, we found some convergence. So whether the how much is relevant or not, it's going to depend. But there's always some observation. And in most systems, its convergence is mostly observed at the gene level, which means that it's very rare that we find only one single mutation. But though we saw one example this week, the week before, where we saw that it was one mutation that was possible for this arginine, I forgot which amino acid was. But it's possible that there's just one amino acid that is selected again and again. But in most experiments, you find convergence at the gene level rather than at the precise mutation. And so, for instance, if you look here in the thermal adaptation, where we had like many replicates, you had this gene was selected to be inactivated. These are indels of different sizes. This is large deletion. This is the number of lineage. And so you find eventually, you know, you had one mutation, one non-synonymous mutation that went found four times, but all the others are quite different, which is not crazy if you think about how the many different ways to inactivate a gene. But what's more surprising is that if you look also at essential genes, like the RNA polymerase, you tend to find the same thing, in which there's like many, you eventually have some hotspots, but eventually you have like many, many, many different targets. Okay, and we'll come back to that.
So this inactivation at a single site is a result of a frame shift? Or
so when it's not codon? So here you find every possible pattern to inactivate a gene. And just sometimes the power when you have many replicates is that you know it's inactivating because you have at least one that is a frame shift, because otherwise you could just find a non-synonymous, and then it's really difficult to say, oh, this is it. But here you have frame shift, you have part of the deletion of part of the gene, and so on. Okay, the pattern may change. If you take another gene, sometimes you just have inactivation of the whole deletion of the whole gene, depending on the neighboring. Here, presumably, the next gene, the genes on both sides are important, because you never found a deletion of the whole gene. You just find small deletion within it. Okay, so we may find very different patterns according to the gene. But for inactivation, you expect that there are thousands of ways. But even for the most conserved genes, and so I'll have a slide on that later on, RPOB is presumably the most conserved gene in E. coli. When we evolve it in the lab, we find that there's like 40 sites that are variable and non-synonymous. Okay? And it's been consistently found in many systems that we usually are not that limited, even within essential gene, in the number of mutations that are found.
Sorry, can you remind me what RPOB does?
It's the RNA polymerase. So it's without it, you cannot do much. Okay, you agree on that.
It's not the well conserved gene, I mean, in terms of sequence, right?
Sorry?
It's not very well conserved in terms of sequence, it's just species, right?
Oh, it's still pretty conserved. And within E. coli, I'll show you a slide. I'll show you a slide later on. So also these terms of, so you have replicates and you see that this convergence at the gene level. Sometimes if you have bigger data sets like we had for the thermal adaptation, we can integrate further. Found, for instance, here, this is those genes do combine to make the 3D structure of the RNA polymerase, and you find that many partners have also targeted. So you can integrate from the gene to the operon to eventually some functional units and find convergence at those levels. Okay? But most of the time, if you don't have enough replicates, you may just find it, the gene is one unit that pops up clearly. Even within population, we can find some conversions. And so, for instance, here, is the colors, whenever you see here, it means that on that branch, you had like two mutations that occur. This is five of the mutations in the Richards experiment that pop up the most frequently. And you can see, for instance, in that population, R minus one, you see that PYTF, okay, is appearing one in that branch, once, a second time here, a third time here, fourth time here, five, six. And so it's only those ones will be the final lineage will start from those ones, but you see that the population has tried six times to inactivate this gene independently. Okay? And this goes back to clonal interference and so on. And just to remind you that, you know, the meaning of convergence at the gene level means there are many possible beneficial mutations in terms of number of sites, but the number of function is not that large. And so consistently we find that it's not that large. Of course, if we wait for long enough, as Rich is doing, we may extend and find more and more genes involved in adaptation. But the big players, usually when you go to a new environment, the big players is a handful of genes, or I mean, it's not a massive number, okay? The genes in which you have benefits of 2, 3, 5%, they're not going to be that many, okay? Then we can also find some epistasis. And the first level of epistasis we find is that as soon as you have those mutations, okay, whenever you find mutation, you see that there's alternative mutation that can be found in those genes. Usually you only find one in each lineage. Okay, let me just illustrate that here. So here it's in the thermal adaptation lineage because we have many replicates. Here's some cluster of genes or single genes, first an ICLR, CLS, row of different genes. And so here, whenever there's a dot, it means that there was one lineage of that specific mutation in ICLR and that specific mutation in CLS. Normally, there should be a straight line on the diagonal, but I took it up. And what's appear clearly is that in most blocks, okay, whenever you have one mutation, you don't have two, except for the RNA polymerase, which is a large gene, may have different functions. But so it means that for all these boxes, it's very significant that if you select for one mutation, okay, you don't select for two. Okay, so it means that as soon as you have this one, all the others are not becoming beneficial anymore. Eventually, they become deleterious. We have some example here. And of course, it's clear in the case of gene inactivation. If you inactivate a gene, if the selection was to inactivate the gene, if you put another mutation, there's no benefit in, you know, killing a dead horse. But then, this also happens in essential genes. Like this is a cluster of genes that are involved in the cell shape, and you found that also. And so you can also show that eventually the combination of the mutation is deleterious because it's like, for instance, if you have a gene that is too highly expressed, it's Chris Marks show that with CHU, they show that, you know, they have one, they overexpress a pathway on a plasmid. And when they selected for it, they found two ways to adapt. And the two ways was one is was to reduce the copy number of the plasmid, and the other one was to reduce the expression of the gene. But if you combine the two, you reduce to a too low level, and so it's becoming deleterious to combine those two mutations. Yep.
But there doesn't seem to be any reason why it should be this pattern should be so prevalent, right? I mean, you could imagine that it would just be the other way around, that you need two mutations to reach the optimal level.
So far, I think most of the time, there may be, it's true, it depends on the term, I think. If you wait for long enough, you may start to see eventually fine-tuning at that level. But usually there would be one big target in that gene, and then that's empirical. I mean, and then later on, you may see some compensation eventually within gene, but it could also happen in other genes elsewhere. So the chance that it's within the gene or elsewhere, is, I don't know what's the fraction. So, yep.
This result sort of seems at odds with the way people do, you know, classically do molecular evolution, at least in animals where you're looking for elevated DNDS at a gene level, and so you have to have multiple hits.
Yeah, except that usually for the genes where you expect to have DNDS and those kind of all the gene, you suspect recurrent diversifying selection. Okay, it's not the idea. You're not focusing on gene when you're just saying, oh, it switched once from that substrate to that one, usually because then you have longer time scale, and so you may not see the signal that well. So usually you expect genes involved, you know, in immune response and all those kind of things. And those ones where you have recurrent change in selection.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the main genes are as a case, but they're certainly not the only one.
But then it will really depend on your time scale. If you just after the switch from one, you know, the enzyme switch to new substrate, and then eventually, if you're lucky enough, if you go just after, you don't expect it to be, you know, many, many mutations inside of it, usually. Yeah?
What does this pattern hold up in the bridges?
I mean, if you wait for long enough, you may see some secondary mutation, but mostly mutators. And so there's not that many genes in which, and then you have, if you do the statistics, by chance, you expect also to see some popping up the average.
Yeah, I mean, just connecting some of these questions, I really do think it's a lot of it is an issue of time scales. So, I mean, Olivier's emphasized really short-term, you know, short-term experiments of a couple thousand, then you get up into the tens of thousands. But again, as I mentioned in my talk, you're still only in a couple of decades. So some of these other patterns, I think, would emerge. Some of the more conventional things that a molecular evolutionist would look at if you're out into the millions or hundreds of millions of generations.
But the point is, by 50,000, there isn't a whole lot of examples of
there aren't very many, except again in the mutators, and I think it's very hard to know which is adaptive.
Yeah.
Yeah, could be another way to look at this, saying, well, the case that Anna was referring to, that you basically optimize a gene versus. You see clearly cases where you try to inactivate the function. And so there's no reason once you have inactivated your function that you would look.
For that is true. But there's also, I mean, in that block, it's just a cluster of essential genes that are involved in the peptidoglycan synthesis and elongation of that. And this is just, and you find the same pattern, which is just find one and not two. And so that's why, Reese?
I actually don't think I mean, it's not surprising to me because we've got such a big target size for other things to happen in such a short term if you don't knock out one. On the other hand, I think it was Art Kuhn, maybe Mike Flitlock, vaguely remembering, and it did some analysis, I think it was HIV, which would be a fairly quickly evolving population where they found...
Exactly. So for virus, I would say for virus, the expectations are quite different because when you have like 10 genes, of course, the chance that you have something, some compensation and stuff within, it's much higher.
Yeah.
Okay, then of course you would expect the thing to hit twice, and then it would also be difficult. I mean, you wouldn't expect anything different by chance, if you have just 10 genes. But here, you may have, many, many different ways.
Can you comment on whether in natural settings where you would have a fluctuating environment, you would also see this because there's another time scale that just cuts off
That's one of the stuff I'm going to talk about. I mean, hopefully we'll get to that.
I don't know if this is, for whatever little it's worth, we've done a bunch of experiments in yeast where we do similar sorts of things and tried many times to produce figures like this, and it never comes out like this. So I mean, that
meaning that
either we're not as good at figuring out what the categories are, or
the selective pressure may be weaker in your system.
Or the selective pressure is weaker, or there's something different about the system.
So you just get a scatter shot?
Yeah, I mean that's what I kind of find this remarkable because, and certainly not trivial because when we try to do it, we can't. So.
I mean, this doesn't for the work that we do with Pseudomonas, not on much shorter time scales, but this doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, we get life rich, and again, qualified by much shorter time scales. Lots of usual suspects, and then a bunch of other stuff. You know, so, but not high density.
Do you have to do something special to make sure that there's no exchange and recombination?
I mean, the cells do not. I mean, those are not able to recombine anymore.
These guys don't have anything that would do that.
I think we also observe some problems. I mean, in drug targets in E. coli, we see mutations in, say, like Jagger's genes, and you see only one. You never see the second one. You see mutations in ribosomal genes, you see only one. You don't see the second mutation. The only exception was, first was folate in the HFR.
I don't want to derail things too much, but they're just sort of an interesting slight twist on one of the things that Olivier said. He mentioned this gene called PYKF that in all these all the long-term lines keeps picking up usually a single mutation, but often repeatedly trying them. And he mentioned that it was a loss of or an inactivation. Actually, in only one population has it, with Tim Cooper, we've been sort of looking at it. In only one population was it truly inactivated, and the others it looks like it was knocked down, but not to zero level. of activation. And interestingly, the one, it's beneficial on the ancestor to knock it out completely, but it's more beneficial to knock it down but not out. And the sickest of all the long-term lines, the one that's been improving at the slowest rate, is the one that actually knocked it out early on, suggesting it kind of got off, kind of got derailed by kind of doing too much of a good thing early on. It's down at the bottom of central metabolism, and but it also turns out to be indirectly involved in glucose transport, so it's kind of complicated.
But to go back to Michael's comment, I think the selective pressure also tend to be bigger in those genes, so that's what we're going to come to the end. I think that may make a difference, because here I'm talking about the big players that have, you know, in a percent or more effect. And of course, if you go to weaker, I guess there would be more. And because whenever we see convergence, there's also two things going on. Is that first you think, oh, wow, it means that, you know, natural selection is at play, because among all the possible changes, you find twice the same and so on. So it's great. But it also means that there's not that many options. Okay, so there's the two facet of constraints that, okay, and so maybe when you go to lower improvement, maybe you have more ways to improve. Like, so now I change from rule to observation, you know, because it's like more, it's like less and less, more and more specific somehow, I'm not sure. But also, we may also find traces of interaction between those different blocks, between the different genes. And either clearly because we find the same pattern because they involve in the same exact function, and so you have different partners of the same protein complex, and okay, whether you have a mutation here or there seems to be doing the same job. So we have example of that, and bring it back to the previous form of epistasis. But others, we have some cases here. So in that, here we colored according to, I'm not allowed to say it in front of Tony, but it's a non-random association of markers. So I'm just looking at, it's not linkage disequilibrium, but let's say I use the statistics of linkage disequilibrium. But Tony doesn't like it, but because I'm not officially doing linkage. But so the idea is that here, in this block, D prime, one of the statistics of linkage disequilibrium, is equal to 1, which means that basically out of the, normally you have four combinations possible. I have one mutation in the RNA pole, and one mutation here. I could have 0 in each lineage with 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. But in that case, I never found mutation in those genes without a mutation in here. Okay, so it means presumably that here, this opened the path to using those pathways. Okay, so if you need to have the mutation in that gene to be able to have mutation in those ones. Yep.
Couldn't an alternative just be that you first get one and then the other? And either, I mean, it could be just, you can get a correlation just without
it. It could, but here we have some cases here, because here there's some specific alleles. So usually, I mean, if we go back, there's two blocks of evolution. You can evolve through that way or through that block. And so here we have some alleles where significantly we can see that when you have some alleles of rho rather than RPOB, you can exclude, you have some alleles. If you mutate rho instead of RPOB, you never find mutation in RPOB if you mutate in rho first. And so we can show that there's a significant decoupling. And then once you're here, you never use those ones. If you have this specific mutation, you never use those pathways. And we have some stats to show that it's really... So there's some... this one is a very large effect. So you could have just correlation because this one is large effect. But we're lucky enough so that there's like another pathway, and then you don't use that one. Okay. But of course, if everybody had it, you couldn't say much. But here we have some power because we have so many replicates to be able to show that. And so there's some paths, you know, that are open because of mutation, but there's also some paths that are closed. And here, that's the paper that Rich presented, and so he talked about that part. But what you can see here is that you have one gene, FAMR, that pops up here. And so in the sequence, also it's occurring early on, and it's never appearing again later on. And when we did with Alejandro, what we did with, we did like transposon-seq in the ancestor. And in that ancestor, you find out, so it means that you do transposon-seq, you estimate the fitness cost of every single gene in the genome simultaneously in the ancestor background. And so here they're ranked according to position. And in the ancestor, you see, you know, PYKF, as Rich said, is beneficial, ROD-Z, FAB-R. You find a bunch of genes whose inactivation is beneficial. FAB-R is among them. But if you do the same after 2,000 generations of evolution, most of them have disappeared. Well, there's just 5 mutations in the genome. And we did that also at 15K. And if you look at, for instance, the first like genes, the 20 genes that have definite improvement in fitness, and look at their fitness now after 2,000 or 15,000 generation, you see that they're not only just not becoming beneficial, but some are becoming very deleterious. Here later on, when you add them, Or FABAR, in the case of FABAR, it's just becoming like neutral. So as soon as you have this mutation, we haven't spotted which one yet, but if you have one mutation in SPOT, top A, one of these mutations is present, this pathway is seen to be shared. So yeah, you have both opening of path and also closing of others, depending when, as soon as you have some mutation, you made it. Yeah?
In the 2000 generation lines, how many of those ones that were initially good to knock out or knocked out?
Sorry?
So in the 2000 generation lines, there's way fewer knockouts that are beneficial. How many of those ones that were good to knock out on the ancestor are actually already knocked out on the...
Oh, after the 2000, it's just like, you just have PYTF among those that is...
That's the only one.
So there's one that is, no. I mean, I'm not even sure it's a full knockout, but this one, the benefit is gone in that one. While the other ones, so it's through regulation, the other genes, the other genes that evolve in supercoiling and so on, they change their expression of many genes. And so you find out that just finding those change the landscape, and so the others.
I think there's a second, I think the NADR is also.
NADR also, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there are at least two of those that actually did get, whether they're true knockouts or down regulation.
Yeah, you can attribute this to epistatic effects rather than just simply climbing in a peak. So you climb a peak, and by definition, your access to beneficial mutations goes down, which is consistent exactly with what you're showing here. But you're attributing it to opening up or closing down particular kinds of pathways.
I mean, it depends whether you look at the genetic, the peak issue is about whether you look at the genetic or phenotypic level. As soon as you cannot use that FABR, it means that genetic pathway is closed. But eventually, phenotypically, you reach the same level because through regulation, you knock it out or you down-regulate it so that there's no issue. But that's another, I have a whole talk trying to fit all this stuff to Fischer geometric model because most of these rules, but physicists don't like Fischer geometric model, so I never talk in that.
I don't mean specifically Fischer's model, but just the concept that you get better.
You could, and actually, for instance, for that one, actually, it's really, it's a rod Z, my understanding. It's really beneficial here, and becoming neutral and becoming deuterious. But at that stage in this lineage, there's like some other mutation that pathway that are involved in cell shape. That's MRAB and so on. And this gene is part of those. That's the same. It's been described to be involved. It's one of the few genes that have a phenotype that can lead to round cells, and so it's linked to this pathway. And so presumably now that you have already this function, now if you add it, now it's becoming extremely deuterious to have this more. So. But it could also be fit with a path in the sense of phenotypic. It could also be due to a single peak because now you reach what you wanted at that for that phenotype, and doing it again is going to be deleterious.
It seems to be that this peak climbing scenario in the absence of epistasis would only work for mutations that have actually been adopted, right? So if you take a mutation, then that's gone, but all the other ones should still be available, right? I mean, the supply of beneficial mutations decreases because you're using the mutations, but if you don't use them, what he's saying is that mutations that have not been used are not longer available, and I think that is epistasis.
That is epistasis in some way. I mean, even on a smooth phenotypic landscape like Fischer geometric model, you have lots of epistasis, underlying epistasis. I mean, the team has been working on that too, and so there's lots of underlying epistasis, so
just to understand, so these are effects, fitness effects of knockouts.
Yeah.
And how does the overall distribution of those knockout effects change? Are you showing this?
No, I'm not going to show it here. So we're working on the data right now. So so we see that the tail is decreasing. How far should I go? Okay, no. But on the deleterious side, we don't see much change. So surprisingly, the deleterious side seems to be fairly stable. While the positive side, you see the tail is decreasing. And if you go initially at the first rounds, you found that if you cannot fit an extreme value theory as an exponential decay for that distribution here, you don't see, it doesn't fit in a classical extreme value theory where you would expect an exponential decay of beneficial. While after, and there's been some debate in the literature that people thought, when extreme value theory came around, people say, okay, it's going to fit. And his work on that, and there were some data showing, it does fit overall, and others showing definitely it does not fit. And then some of the issue was like, but maybe one of the idea of extreme value theory is that, you have a distribution of fitness, but then usually when you're adapted, you're really on the right-hand side, and so because of that, you can say that, overall, the distribution could fit something that is exponential with an exponential decay. But one of the points is that if you're not that well adapted, it may not fit that. And so here we see that starting from the ancestor, you seem to be away from that tail. But as you move through time, then the fit to an exponential seems to be really matching. So we have that switch. But on the deleterious side, we don't see much. It's really, it seems to be really stable. And then at the functional level, genomic functional level, you see that lots of genes are in activation. And also, the first targets, as Rich said, also tend to be those global regulators, like genes that have large effect, like the RNA polymerase. I told you, what can you find is more pleiotropic than the RNA polymerase? Okay, it's changing the regulation potentially of everything. Okay, or we find RPOS in other system, or SPOT, supercoiling. So that this is. So one of the questions then is, how much of that is true in vivo? And why is it relevant to ask that question? Because as Rich said, you know, he took a random strain in a random environment somehow, and that's what we all do when we do experimental evolution. Usually we take a lab strain, put it in a lab, and that's not much to do with nature, apart from the few ecologists who try to do some stuff here. But other than that, we've been always putting it in the moon. You know, it's something completely different.
Pardon me?
Yep.
Did you say just now on the previous slide that some of the genes that you find inactivated include polymerase subunits?
No, not inactivated. I'm saying that just
we
found lots of inactivation overall.
Yeah.
And then also some of the first targets will not be, of course, inactivation, but some of the first targets tend to be very important genes, central genes in metabolism or in the regulation.
So we were looking at molecular evolution of some stuff and some animals, and one of the things that we found were that many of the polymerase subunits are duplicated. And there are certain subsets of those duplications that evolve at different rates than others, specifically in different tissues. Now, I know this is a unicellular system, but I'm wondering to what extent you have polymerase subunits or even ribosomal subunits being coded for by duplicate genes, and if one member of the family is evolving rapidly, whereas another is not. Are there patterns like that?
So here, here we found lots of sigma factors can be targeted as targets for adaptation. Actually, it's usually what's used. People in the industry who wants to improve strain, they want to target those genes. You know, they want E. coli to grow in whatever pH, in whatever temperature. They will target those genes because these are the ones that open the most wild, that are most prone to adapt to having some adaptive mutations in those backgrounds. So people like in Boulder and stuff, they do that. And so yeah, they are targets if you want to go broad. But in the wild, let me just show you that the next slide actually. In the wild, like for instance, this is RPOB. This is the mutation we found in the lineage, the non-synonymous mutation we found in the experimental evolution thermal adaptation. This is 123 genomes of E. coli sampling the whole diversity of the species, like so millions of years of evolution. And you have like five. This is the gene of 4 kb, you know, 1300 codons, and you have like five non-synonymous mutations in that gene. So it's extremely conserved in the wild, and experimental evolution, and RPOB is, we found it in thermal adaptation, but in many, many other experimental, like Palsen in San Diego, find it recurrently being the targets of selection. So sometimes it's less diversity, because eventually he found, in one experiment, he found consistently like one in RPOC, one small deletion, but it's because the mutation rate of that one is much higher than the others, but then there's other mutation also that can pop in. So you have some genes like this, and in many systems where we found they're extremely variable in experimental evolution, they're often recruited and changed, while in the wild they're super conserved. So one of the questions, you know, what's going on?
What do the colors mean?
Hmm? The colors means, I think it's the type of mutation from, base substitution. Well, I guess you should have four colors, I guess, or maybe more. I forgot. Okay. So to try to go around that, we decided to do some one step, and a small step towards more natural system is to evolve E. coli in the mice. And so it's a small step. You're going to see why. But it's the idea is that, okay, it's more natural. It's the natural environment. It's the gut of vertebrate. Though the mice doesn't have usually E. coli at high level. So depending on the animal facility, sometimes they have. But so other people have done that. Even during my PhD, we did that using some actinic mice. But you know, the more we know about the microbiota, the more we know that actinic mice are just like another test tube, because it's nothing to do with nature. So it's really weird. And so because the immune system is completely changed and so on. So here what we use two things. That we use something that I'm sure is not perfect, but is cheap enough to do long-term. And long-term for us was a year. and in which we put E. coli, but not around another lab E. coli. We took a natural isolate, one of those B2 strains that is a worry now, that is highly virulent. It's, if you put not in the gut, but in the blood of this mice, the mice is dying in about 15 hours. It was 100% efficiency. But we put it in the gut, because we're nice. And we gave some antibiotic to the mice, 5 gram per liter. And this strain is highly resistant to that antibiotic, streptomycin. And streptomycin is antibiotic that's just killing enterobacteria. So we're cleaning the niche of E. coli to be able to put E. coli inside of it, because it's really tricky to actually inject a strain within a host. Because in nice papers in the 60s where they tried to do that in the dog, and in the end they finished by killing the dog because they couldn't find any way to do it. In the 60s they were allowed to do this stuff.
Antibiotic is administered to the water?
Yeah, it's in the water. We put it in the water of the mice. They drink it. And the strain, so the 5 gram per liter, but the strain is resistant to up to 200 gram per liter. It's starting to be a puree when you want to put. It's really expensive to do. And at that level, we cannot even measure anymore the level of resistance because there's so much that the excipient and all this kind of stuff put a mess. Okay. So we evolved 15 different cages with 2 mice in each. And in the end, we sequence, so that's the average, you know, density of E. coli initially. The niche is slightly higher than what we'd expect for E. coli in there because of the antibiotic we cleared slightly a bit larger, okay? So we have 10 to the 8 that stabilized after some time. And then in the end, we just sequence 1 clone of each. So just in terms of number of point mutation, after a year of evolution, we found about 5, which is what we found in Richard Zelensky's experiment after a year or so. Initially that, but in the thermal adaptation we found twice more. Okay.
Sorry.
Yep.
You say they are killed in 15 hours in the blood, but in the gut they survive.
In the gut they survive. Well, the mice are happy. I mean, then we realize actually we have a whole process now going on because it was the first time we were doing something long term, and then 30% of the mice died, and we say okay, that's part of their life. But actually, those mice are supposed to live 2 or 3 years.
Absolutely. So the default protocol is to keep them for a year in a given mice.
Yeah. Yeah. And then now we're working on that. Maybe that E. coli is, especially now we're doing a Western diet and we're doing 2 different diets. We're doing lots of other experiments on that and finding that eventually this strain may sometimes go in the blood and kill and create some lesions in the liver and create and kill some of the mice. So
these are reproducing mice over the years?
No. Here we put them just females. We put that here. Now we have another experiment where we try to go. Okay, let me.
So what's the number of generations per day?
So that's the big debate, okay? So here, if you used to Camilla Rank, she showed in the 90s that using the, Teowa said, the number of ribosomes, if you quantify the number of ribosomes in the E. coli just coming from the mice, you could estimate there was up to 18 generations a day. That's what people say, and so it's been measured again. Isabel Gordeaux is doing a lot of stuff like this too, lots of nice work. The downside, I think, to her work is that she used a lab strain that has been highly modified, a K12 that has not seen a gut for almost a century. And so some of the results are due to defects that this strain has accumulated. So it's hard to know whether this strain was extremely maladapted. But she found also this idea of many generations. Like others argue that it could only be 5 or 6. So that's why in the end, I'll show some. We have some. We don't know exactly. And that's an important issue, yeah.
So when you just put these, the mouse during the...
We put E. coli. We inject them with E. coli, okay. And
then you just leave them for
just
a year.
We leave them happily ever after.
And the streptomycin
until we kill them. I mean, that's
right.
But
the streptomycin
is in the water continuously.
It's in the water continuously,
yeah.
At the same concentration.
Yeah.
But what do you need it for? I mean, just
because otherwise it's really tricky to keep E. coli. So you might have other. We're not in a sterile environment fully. We are in those cages. But it's not like fully sterile. I go and talk to people that have actinic mice, and they say, "Oh yeah, what you're doing is great. We could do some work with you." And say, "Okay, I want an incubator for a year." Oh, then they're gone. Okay, because it's when they do the, those actinic mice, it's extremely expensive.
To keep them
exactly, because
to
keep them in a sterile environment where you control everything. So for us, we use streptomycin to enforce the fact that we keep that strain here, because. And when we don't, we did another experiment in which we give that to the mother. We did the streptomycin to the mother that was pregnant. And then we stop giving the antibiotic. It gives birth to baby mice. I don't know how to call those. And then they transmit naturally the microbiota. They keep it, but then they keep it to a low level. And that may be one of the first experimental evolution where we don't see any adaptation because the numbers are 10 to the 3 bacteria somehow over a year. And so we don't see much at the genetic level. Yep.
So at the end of the year, you can check the E. coli that you put in, but aren't there other bacteria in there that colonized over the year and became streptomycin resistant?
Not that much. No. We plate in streptomycin, we don't find.
Nobody?
Yeah, no. That are aerobic, but most of the others are not targets usually of that.
So can you tell us anything about the community other than E. coli?
Communities?
In the gut, there are other organisms, as you alluded, or...
There are what?
Are other organisms in the gut?
Yeah, there's the whole, it's a normal, I mean, they have a microbiota.
Yeah. And what about the possibility of horizontal gene transfer?
So we haven't seen any when we sequence those. We haven't seen any in these experiments.
And you are Lumina sequencing?
We did Lumina sequencing, and there's no read that is coming outside yet. Yeah. And so... So Isabel Gordo has managed to see some phage coming in. But it all depends, because for us, in our animal facility, they never have E. coli. In other places, they have some that have E. coli. So it really depends. It depends on the country, the animal facility that starts. And so some may have some residual E. coli being sitting around, and so it makes it easier, while others don't. So that's something, when we use this parameter, we don't control everything.
Well, Isabel has seen large insertions.
No, she saw IS change. Okay, we don't see almost. We almost see no IS, but she saw IS change also because it's a lab strain, and lab strains IS elements tend to be more mobile than in the natural isolates. And so, if we go back to some of the rules that we saw, we observe also that KK is equal to 2. We also have convergence at the gene level. You see that there's the number of replicate affected. We see that the bunch of genes here that have many mutations. Some are gene inactivation, most of them actually. But then we don't see global regulator, but we see two things. So some metabolic pathway among the big target for which we understand something. You have some metabolic genes and some streptomycin resistance. So for the metabolic pathway, I work on E. coli because whenever you have something, you go to EcoSite, it tells you all this stuff. And if you go, wow, we found lots of mutation inactivating that gene that was supposed to be a repressor of that pathway, the galactonate pathway. We show that it was actually functional in the system. If you put some galactonate, you induce the pathway, and so it's really functional. But then, okay, there's two papers on that pathway in 1972, and that's it. And so then we understood why. Because when you want to buy galactonate, it costs an arm, okay? It's basically, one microgram is costing like $500 or something like this. So you cannot do that as much experiment as you want. But when we look at the pattern, okay, we found that, the ancestor has no mutation in none of these genes. But when we looked, we found that, most of the lineage had inactivated DGOR through different types of mutation. But then among those that inactivated that, some had point mutation in DGOD, and among the ones that inactivated DGOD, some had mutation in DGOT. And so there's a statistical, not always, but this is specifically occurring in the background statistical. So here also we find this idea of epistasis of either, just one mutation is required within that, and you cannot have two, it's not necessary. But then also you have dependency that you only mutate those ones when this pathway has been activated. Okay? Then we could also do some experiments and show that actually we have another spot also, but the doubling time in galactonate is really long. And then if you have inactivate DGOR, you improve it. And actually, if you inactivate DGOR and DGOT and you put the three mutation, then you have eventually the lineage that have these three mutations grow even slightly faster.
So inactivating the DGOR, that's inactivating repressor. So you're upregulating, and what do you think the whatever those other two genes are? I mean, are those like refining an enzyme, or you just don't know at this point?
So the question also, whenever you hit that, there's several issues. The one is that it's a pathway, but maybe there's other sugar that may pass through that. Yeah. That's one of the questions, because it's very unknown, but potentially you could have other genes, because we're surprised to see that in the lab it's really inducible. So you think, why the hell would I need to inactivate the repressor? Well, I found that, if I put some galactonate, a full induction. But still, we find some effect. So it's possible that there's still an effect on galactonate. Then the question is, where could that galactonate come from? And some bacteria produce it, some aerobic bacteria. they can produce it, and then it can be used, or some people with some galactosemia disease can also overproduce it, but there's no clear link where. But then there may be one nasty one, is that Philip Sansonetti found that in the crypts, you have lots of, at low levels, some bacteria that are actually soil bacteria that can live here because it's aerobic in the crypts of the gut. And among those, you have some strains that have been shown to produce some galactonate, and those strains are naturally resistant to streptomycin. So one possibility, and in one case we have isolated some of these strains, but it's, you know, organism not well known and characterized, so, but it's possible that eventually all this is linked also to streptomycin. That's one hypothesis, that we change the environment and the microbial interaction and the product and so on. But then there's also genes involved in streptomycin resistance. Actually, those genes have never been described to be involved in any resistance in E. coli to streptomycin, but if you look in weird bacteria, in mycobacteria and so on, if you inactivate that, you increase your resistance to that. And those two genes are involved in modification of the ribosome in some way, and you find that, you know, either you get one or the other. You really have an exclusion, very clear exclusion. And then my policy is to use the mice for doing the long-term experiment, but not to use them as test tube to do the short-term assay. So as long as I can find some phenotype in the lab that works, I'm not going to want to kill mice just to test the stuff. So that's why we do that in vitro. And so if we take those lineage, if we inactivate GB, RLED, and do the double mutants, in LB, we find that especially RAL RLED has a cost. You know, it's increasing the doubling time, so it's a cost of deleterious gene. The other one is less clear. But in the presence of streptomycin, you see that they grow much faster. Okay, both are an improvement. That doesn't explain fully why you exclude one another, because you could think that at least if you go through RLUD, you don't want to have GB. It's not useful anymore. But in that background, it may. Okay, so we don't know why.
Why are strains going so slowly in LB?
Oh. This is LB. This is a train. This, because we're doing that in microtiter plates, and in it's 536. It's natural isolate. That's what we have here.
And so if you take your lab strain, it will go down.
But still, in microtiter plates, you know, the growth rate is not.
Yeah, no. But just to never mind. Compared to your lab strain, this is slower.
Yeah, this is slower. This one is not the fastest yet. But here, yeah, and in streptomycin, you see there's so, but because we could not measure any change in the MIC, in the resistance, because it's so high that we cannot see, but we see that there's an effect. And so I told you, we're going to go to a more natural environment. And then we see that a lot of the response could be due to what we put as streptomycin. So we're not fully satisfied with that. And so then the next step is to try to go in the wild. Yep.
Could you count somehow the number of new true mutant mutations that you found, and perhaps use that to estimate the number of generations?
The number of what? Of new
generations. You said that's a debate.
So based on the number of mutation, I mean, we find out that in that, based on the few synonyms we have and so on, according to the numbers, it seems that this 18 is not that far. I mean, we're not off the range. But, you know, a twofold factor from 18 to 9 generation, we're not that precise to estimate that, and strains can have a twofold difference in their native mutation rate, so it's not that precise, okay? So you have to use other tricks, and I think Johan Paulsen has tried to develop some tricks with some, I don't know, cycling stuff, and he said it must be much shorter, but I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, you presumably only have a handful of synonymous changes across all the cages.
Exactly, yeah. We just have very, very few, and So, then what people look is that if you look what happens, then rather than putting strain in somebody, which is still difficult to do, and so we want to work, why do we want to work in human? It's not just only because we are human, it's also because it's E. coli and human have a specific relationship, not just in our lab, but okay, if you sample all the vertebrates, the human is the only one where there are 100%, you find E. coli in 100% prevalence. In all the other vertebrates we tried, and Eric Denamur has been trying many, it's always lower. So there's something special about human and E. coli. That's why we're cloning it. But then, so some colleagues in another lab a few years ago, what they did is that actually the wife got a urinary tract infection, and so he started to follow people in his family. And so over the years, he sampled, you know, his daughters, his dog, and found that one strain was around over several years. And then they sequenced the genome. And what they found out is that you see that an isolate in 2008 and an isolate in 2007, you know, just four mutations apart. So you can have like stuff that are distant from 5-6 years that are just 4 or 5 mutations apart. And so it's much, much lower than what we found when I told you over a year we find 5 mutations in mice, and in experimental evolution we find much more. But this strain was not a dominant strain, so it's hard to know. It was, you know, how much has it spent, you know, transiting. It was up and down. It was not recovered at some time points here. If you don't see it, it was not recovered here, where it was recovered there. So we don't know about the history. So we dig in our freezers, and we found out another person, this time a member of the lab, that we had followed for a year. And this time he had a strain that was dominant, fully dominant, because all the clones we isolated were that clone, over a full year. And then we did the same, and we sequenced, but once again, so this is the different sequences we have, so this is, we correspond to one mutation, and so over a year, you have, you know, one clone that, you know, one mutation got fixed over a year. And so it's hard to know, but it doesn't seem to be that active. And so I think Benjamin Good also has been doing some experiment now, large scale, using some, he presented that in SMB, and in other microbes too, where people look at those patterns, you know, using like full metagenomics and trying to get the number of evolution. And they found that for most of those bugs, you know, you find one mutation per year, something that is what you usually find. So much, much lower than what you have. Then an old paper. So these are just random work, yeah.
I mean, although you said it's kind of inconsistent with the experimental evolution, as you also pointed out, the experimental evolution is typically putting things in an incredibly novel environment. And most of those are adaptive mutations. So in fact, it seems like maybe it's not all that.
Yeah, we're gonna come to that. Yeah. And so then the question is, what happens during infection? So usually when people, the medical doctors sample an infection, they just take one E. coli. And so here we collected a bunch of 19 different infections. And it was we did that a long time ago, but so at the time it was still difficult to sequence, so but we use old school polygenic electrophoresis fields, so on, to find differences among the strains. And in 8, we couldn't find much differences. But in 7, we could find that there was some microheterogeneity. In 3 cases, you had actually 2 different clones in the infection, but one had microheterogeneity, and in 1, you had 3. Of course, this would correspond to an infection that is closer to the gut, like, you know, post-appendicitis or something like this, where you have, where, okay, there, some stuff from the gut went into the blood, and so that's what you got. But then we had always some heterogeneity, and you may question, okay, what's this heterogeneity about?
These samples were all from blood or from tissue? Or?
It depends. You have some. I don't want to go into the gory details, but some are like deep pus involved, and some are brain tumors, and some ugly stuff. And here, what you find some of the diversity that do matter, actually for medical doctors, that these are 2 almost identical strains that you sample, and you plot spread them on a plate and put some antibiotic disc, and so here you have the antibiotic that diffuses. And so here you see no growth, which means that it's sensitive to amoxicillin, to sulfonamine, and to streptomycin, and resistant to tetracycline. But this is a strain just about identical in the same isolate, in the same infection, that is fully resistant. So if you pick that one and decide you're going to treat that person with amoxicillin, it's a bad choice, okay? And then what you also can see is that those clones are almost identical, but if you measure some growth rates, you see that they have completely different patterns. So we could find out that this was linked to RPOS balance. And when we did some healthy individual for both resistance or growth variability, we find that here we had much more, it was significant, we had much more of this diversity within infection than compared to what we found in the gut of normal people. And so at the time, we'd also sequenced one of the 4 clones from one, and we find quite a bit of mutation, eventually convergence with 2 mutations in the home. So to come back to what I thought would be the first part of the talk, we have the idea about, if we go back to the rate of evolution, what we observe is that when you're fully maladapted, you have an extremely high rate of adaptation. And you see all those patterns that I described, okay? Then if it's better adapted, you start with a lower rate of genomic evolution, and through time, we saw that it's decay. In the mice, it's difficult to know, but we see, because based on the number of generation, if we believe the estimates from Camilla Rang, we found that it's slightly lower, and in human, eventually even lower. And so the idea is that it does fit, as you said, that eventually they're fairly well adapted, and so, of course, there's not much pressure for the strong adaptation, okay? But then what happens when we have an infection?
Sorry, just a question about this. I mean, does this depend on population size, too?
it's made that population size are large in the gut. In the, I mean, it's hard to know exactly because there may be some death rate and so on. But E. coli in the human gut is about 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 per gram of feces, and you have quite a gram, quite a few grams of feces overall, and so it makes like the population is fairly large. And
it's not, but how does it compare to the experimental evolution?
It's larger than what we have in the experimental evolution, I would say. Each individual.
But also in infections?
In infections, more tricky to know, because it's so it depends really on how fast it goes and so on. But we know that transiently, so those infections, we have the idea that things go faster here. Okay? And why? Because here, why would it go faster? Because here, as Richard, you're in a new environment. And specifically, when specifically that environment is that you don't have 500 other species bothering you anymore. And we saw that all those species could define your niche and, you know, don't eat this, don't eat that, this is mine for those sugars and so on. Well, when you arrive in the blood or in the bladder or in all those spaces, then it's a free space. And then you can have all this ecological diversification where we see some cross-feeding, all this kind of thing that are not possible in the gut because there's other species at play here. And so if you put some acetate in the gut, who cares, you know? While if you're in your deep pus, you know, in a clustered environment like this, you can have all this evolution going on that is not possible. And so that leads to an ecological radiation. And somehow, this would mimic more what we observe in experimental evolution in terms of rate and patterns, where also here you can find, we find mutation in global regulators. Here was mostly RPOS patterns of the use of nutrients that you would diversify, either go to more protection or to go to being more open and being able to feed, which actually makes you even more sensitive to antibiotics. Some are really being open and taking everything, so even more antibiotics if it arrives, while others are trying to shut it down. And we have this whole gradient of stuff going on here that we don't seem to see in the gut. And so,
coming back to the question of population sizes, I mean, how well we understand the gut as a chemostat, right? There's a lot of pieces, but it's like continuously going out. So actually, what does it mean to take over that population? Perhaps
if
we're at the very top and stay there. And
no, because you have all the mucus. So it's all along the mucus. E. coli is on the side. So E. coli is really an important component of the gut because, you know, the gut is anaerobic, but it's anaerobic thanks to E. coli mostly. Because E. coli, you have a flux of oxygen coming from your organs. You are aerobic somehow, and you have a flux of oxygen. And E. coli will use that oxygen. So that's why you need E. coli to come first in the gut, so that then it's going to take all the oxygen and open the niche for the others. And so it's on the side of all. So it's difficult to know that. These are important questions. We have no clue about that. And it's tricky because you have to look carefully at how to measure effective population size in those conditions. It's not easy. We would like to do that with some barcodes and see whether we could have some stuff going on. So that's some of the ideas that we have here.
I mean, I'm just asking because you seem to say that the reason why they evolve in soy is because they're the well adapted. And there could be many other reasons why they evolve in soy because of the spatial structure in the gut, which is size effect. And so
what we know is that, I mean, that it's true. I mean, it's true, but it's not clear exactly why. I mean, one of our ideas is that there's also lots of fluctuation in those environments. And so in Richard's setting, you know, if you have a mutation that is, you know, 0.1% benefit, it's going to be selected for. And those 0.01 benefit, you know, you may have thousands of them in the genome. So you're going to wait and you're going to keep seeing adaptation. In the wild, those mutations are 0.01, it's just going to be transient, and the environment's going to shift to something else in between, and so you're not going to be able to select them that easily either. Okay, so that's one of the ideas too. I mean,
I'm confused about your wild, because the wild, when you looked at the infections, was not the gut, right? It was actually gut bacteria that managed to get into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
But if they'd be in the gut, they'd be completely fine and happy.
Yeah, that's where they're here, yeah.
Look in the gut itself, is it the same thing, that there's just one dominant strain?
No, then we have ecology going on. So that's what is tricky. What we know is that there's other reasons. So one of the things is, that's why it's not studied that well, is that we find that there's like a... when you follow an individual, sometimes we don't know why another strain may come in and take over. And so suddenly, abruptly, and so someone is taking over, and that's what we're trying now to go and investigate. But you need some close time-up series for many people to be able to do that, which, you know, for sick people, we got recording some data, because sick people, you know, they don't care about being sampled. Happy people don't like to give their poop. And so it's like it's more difficult to have like real-time series of people that are not just people from the lab. So we're going to do with people from the lab, but it's not easy to have access to. So kids with cancer, kids with like people with cirrhosis, all this kind. Oh, we have access, but these are weird environments, plenty of antibiotics, plenty of things going on.
But then do we know anything about the mutation rate? I mean, does the ecology, which is just like sort of
that's why this data set that I present is quite unique, and there's not that many. So now people are trying to collect those where you have some people that where the strain remained for long enough time so that you could see some evolution going on. Because usually you have one strain, then it may pop up again years later, but you don't know where it's been. You know, you don't know whether it's been down. And though you could see its adaptation, of course there's adaptation, but this is more due to ecology, like some stuff has changed. Like allelopathy, you may have like some...
So you're basically saying the ecological time scale takes over before you have time to see it.
Exactly. In many cases, we have a really hard time doing that. And so you have to, and so that's why, for instance, the James Johnson paper, where he followed his family, is like one case where they could find that there was one clone that remained in the family, but it was, if you follow, it disappeared in many individuals at a given time point, but they could find it back later on. So you don't know what happened in the meantime. Was it just at very low level somewhere? But we don't know. So that's even though E. coli is, you know, one of the best studied organisms, there's still a lot that we don't know on all these issues.
For what it's worth, Olivier, just to speak to this point, I mean, there are other kinds of infections that are also being studied. I mean, we study Pseudomonas aeruginosa in the CF lung, where CF cystic fibrosis adult patients, almost between nearly 80% of them are chronically infected with Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Right? So there you've got an increasing number of time series, you've got opportunity for cross-sectional studies, comparative genomic studies, as well as we do similar experiments in the lab. So the ecology here is super important, and some systems are going to be easier to track than others.
No, for us, I mean, we're interested in that one because a lot of the reason also we're interested because, as I told you, some of the pathogenic strains that are creating the trouble in the hospital, we show that their benefit is in the gut. They're invading as common cells, not as pathogens. And so we need to understand what's going on in the gut, and we're really trying to look, but it's not easy to look after the ecology of those bugs. I mean, even though we know it well, you know, so I guess I can... have another talk. So we could eventually stop there. It's just
that was quick.
Just to put the acknowledgement somewhere. Oh, yeah.
We'll have another talk by Olivier.
Yeah.
I got it.
Just, this may sound like shameless self-promotion, but don't mean it to be, but on the issue of how closely does the lab in vitro work match the in vivo stuff, we've seen with the Pseudomonas aeruginosa that it was a much closer match, depending on the conditions in which you...
Yeah.
So we actually recapitulate a lot of the phenotypes in vitro that we see that clinical microbiologists will isolate from patients.
Yeah, but for you, it's the same. No, so for us, it's quite different. I mean, so far, it was really, I showed you, it was a few case studies. So now we're trying to go to larger scale. One of the issues that E. coli genome, actually, these are those slides, you know, that the paper where we sequenced some of the early genomes of E. coli. The genome is really diverse, and so you need a very good reference to be able to fine tune, and if you want to identify every single mutation, you need an extremely nice reference. And when we do all those Illumina, that's why I would like to go to nanopores to combine and to have a nice reference, and then to be able to see diversity. But because here, you know, we did a long time ago, is that when you look at, you know, what the number of genes that are conserved, it's really a fraction, and so half of the genome is not going to be in the core genome. And so if you want to look at evolution, you cannot say, oh, I'm just going to look at the conserved part, because otherwise I may miss everything. And what just Eric published is that then they did the same when they looked just at this clone of E. coli, and this is the same pattern in terms of the content of genes. So it's fractal somehow. You look at one space, and you find also that there's thousands of genes in the pangenome, and a few in the core genome. So all around, even if you look closely and you think you have a reference that is close enough, they may also differ by you know, many, many, many genes around. And so that makes it difficult to go for to those fine-scale genetic studies as we can do in Richard's case, because we have a very nice... I mean, it's a lot of luck, because RL606 has not that many prophages in it and so on. Because even in other genome where we have a nice annotation, there's like some prophages that are partially repeated, and so on, that makes all the analysis always much tougher than in RED 606. And so that's why also we're limited in those processes for now. Yep.
Just making a different kind of plug, though. I mean, I think one of the really cool things about this field, and I think there's a huge future opportunity for one or more institutions to grab hold of this, and I think they're doing it in various ways, but it's combining the theory, the experiment, the epidemiology. I mean, it's just a hugely important future area where the kind of people in this room have just tremendous opportunity to contribute. And I think throwing any one of those out, and I think you're losing a lot. So, I mean, there's great experimental evolution, there's great theory, there's great epidemiology, but it's this intersection I just think creates an amazing opportunity and for a center, or for an institute, or whatever. And, you know, the NSF is on board with this. I'm not sure the NIH is as on board with it in the U.S. as they should be.
But what we figure out, so we have something like 80,000 E. coli in our freezers. But now what we figure out is that we need, you know, not only to have them, but to have the microbiota, to have some, you know, the antibiotic consumption. And so now we're trying to go the food habits of the people. So now we're trying to connect with people who are following the food habits of people. For they're following 100,000 people. So we're trying to follow people with very clear different, you know, diets and just eat sausages, or they're just are vegans. And we're trying to see whether there's some biases here that we could extrapolate. But you need a lot. It's just that sampling now is the question. So is the quality of the sampling and how much information you have in those stuff moving forward. Okay.
Just make one more remark from this. There are a lot of, so in evolution studies, there are a lot of characterization of the sequences of what's going on, comparison of the fitness and all that. Very little characterization of physiology.
Yeah, I mean, that's the next step too. I mean,
whatever the reality of what's happening.
So there's some paper, as Eric von Nimwenk said, he tried to use his 100 E. coli and tried to do gross weight on 100 of them. And you know, at first he thought he would have some nice quantitative traits. Then after 3 years, he went, I'm just going to say, grow doesn't grow in those different conditions, because it's tricky. So there's some T-Pass is doing that in Oxford. The characters, they took like 200 strains and they phenotyped them on 300 or 400 phenotypes, just doing gross curves. But usually these are very crude estimates where they just do colony size growth. And so some people are trying, I agree, it's the next stage. And that's
a lot more than just gross curves.
Hmm?
It's a lot more than just
testing. I know. There's many steps, but then it's more work now almost. And so you have to have those, if you want to look large collection, you need the robots, you need all these kind of things. And so it's so you can do on a subsample, very fine scale, or intermediate samples, like you know, fairly gross assays and gross doesn't.
I mean, just compare the efforts to how much is invested in figuring out exactly how sequence expands and shrink and all that. It's very, very little.
Yeah. Right. No, I agree. I mean, the next stage. I mean, now sequencing is free somehow, not fully. But the next stage is going to be, of sequence doesn't say much, you know, and so in the next stage is going to be to phenotype. That's for sure. Yeah.